So far, I think this is the first film that we've reviewed that did not feature a nude swim.
Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And welcome back to our ongoing movie roundtable series here at TLR, in which we are continuing to discuss movies that have relevance in some way or other to the themes explored on TMR over the last several years. Now, so far we've looked at The Brotherhood of the Bell, Batman the Movie, 12 Monkeys, The Illustrated Man, and lastly Silent Running, which we of course encourage you to go and check out if you haven't heard those yet. But today, for number six in the series, we're going to be talking about the film The Insider from 1999, starring Russell Crowe, Al Pacino, and Christopher Plummer, directed by Michael Mann, which I think is an excellent thriller based upon the true life experience of a man called Dr. Jeffrey Wigand, who was tobacco industry. He was a high-up executive in the tobacco industry and a research scientist, and he famously blew the whistle on Brown and Williamson, the tobacco company for which he worked, because of certain practices within that company that he believed were seriously unethical, and his life was turned upside down in very dramatic ways. As I say, it's based upon that experience, and no doubt we'll discuss to what extent we think the film faithfully captures the reality of all that. But first, let me welcome back our good friends Frank Johnson, Mark Campbell, and making his first appearance in this particular series, but nevertheless a repeated guest on TMR itself, another good friend of the show, Anthony Rotuno. Gentlemen, welcome back, or welcome for the first time to the series, to the TMR Movie Roundtable, gentlemen.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me again. Yeah, thank you.
I feel like someone that's just turned up at a party that's been going for ages, seeing as you've done five of these roundtables.
Wow.
That's good to be here.
I should have asked you before. I don't know why I didn't. there we go.
Well, actually, since I last talked to you, Julian, I've been doing a few film reviews. I've appeared on a few other podcasts, actually.
Ah, right.
They're such good fun. And yeah. I mean, the one we got today is so much material, isn't it? Mm.
Ah, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Last night, loads and loads of ideas were coming into my mind and I couldn't get them down quickly enough. But whether we'll get through them all, I don't know.
Me too.
Anyway, let's just go around each one of us. I mean, how are things going generally with you? I mean, Anthony, you're moving house. Is it tomorrow? You're moving house?
Well, it's officially today, but it'll take a few days to get everything in there. It's all obviously complicated because of the situation, but yeah, I'm in Tunbridge, about an hour from London. Came back from Spain last year, about the last time I spoke to you, actually.
Yeah.
It's always quiet around here. The effect of what's happened in the last 6 months, it's almost like it hasn't been felt so much. If I look out my window here, you know, it doesn't seem so different. Mm. It's like a horror story that's been going on the news, you know, and I haven't really seen much of it. Mm. It got very heavy there.
But you kept your podcast going. I think you've done more on your podcast in recent times than in...
I mean, that's the thing, you know, this situation is good for podcasting, if I'm being perfectly honest. And I don't really mention what's been going on this year in my podcast, because my podcast is obviously about John Lennon. So I kind of have it as something separate for people to listen to and forget what's going on in the news, kind of thing, you know. Mm.
Okay, so I'll direct people to that, as I'm sure I have done before. That's the Glass Onion podcast, isn't it?
Glass Onion on John Lennon, yeah.
Yeah. Frank, are you lurking there in the background still?
Yes, I am. Just finishing up a little chat with Jeff Goldblum. I'm just kidding.
Oh, I believed you.
Well, I do think you must be on very good terms with him, because you do keep mentioning him every time you come on. How are things over there? I mean, now that you know who's going to be the next president?
Yeah, that's the thing. It's a little bit stressful at times because... I mean, even if you don't care too much about politics, at least for me, it's like there's clearly one person we don't want to be in, and there's clearly another who's less horrible to have in. So it's like trying to see both of them sort of softly say they won and then have the media pushing for one way, even in spite of contradictory evidence. Actually, that was one of the things I noticed about this movie, was like it seemed back when they were doing this movie, like, there was something called journalistic integrity, which in the last, I don't know how long, 20 years at least for sure, has kind of slowly whittled away. It's clear you can see very clear biases these days.
It's interesting you should say that, because I was listening to an interview with Lowell Bergman since the making of this film.
Uh-huh.
And he was saying something along those lines, that he didn't think this kind of story could come out these days.
I would agree with him. Absolutely. Mm. I mean, it barely came out as it is.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think it would come out. No, mm. You're totally right.
So is it all cut and dry then, Frank? You got a new president and that's it?
Yep. Nothing to see here at all. It's everything by the book and cut and dried. Very clear.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's move on then. Mark, how's life in London?
It's good, thanks. I'm moving house as well.
Tomorrow?
No, right now. Just over in the corner. That's it. Just by the sofa. No, I'm not. We've only just bought a house. Bought it a few days ago. So probably won't be moving into after Christmas the way things go in this country.
Is it the one with the swimming pool?
No, sadly not. No, because you didn't give me the money for it,
no.
As you promised.
The very strange thing about that was that you sent me a link to the house that you described as having a swimming pool, and I couldn't find a swimming pool anywhere.
Oh, right. It was in that building with the swimming pool in it?
No, you must have sent me the wrong link.
Oh, no, well, it wasn't advertised on the spec, and we turned up, and the woman said, oh, and in here is the heated swimming pool. What? And it's in there, they've got a big sort of outhouse, if you like, and inside it's this swimming pool.
So you weren't kidding? I thought you were kidding.
No.
Wow.
But they wanted too much for us to afford, and right. Actually the cost of a swimming pool that is a sort of a great big canvas thing on a sort of a frame is only about £500.
Cool. All right.
They wanted considerably more than that, so we just sort of backed out of that one. But it was very tempting. Mm. So we're moving to somewhere called Crayford, which is not far from where we live now, in Kent. In a few months' time. But there is a lockdown at the moment, but you wouldn't know it. Traffic is just as bad. The roads are just as congested. There are just as bad many people out. I guess lots of shops are closed. But other than that, it's still a lot of people out and about. So it's nothing like the lockdown that we had before.
Yeah, it's the same here. It doesn't feel like it.
No, it just makes life very annoying. Like I was going to take some stuff to a charity shop. Oh, no, I can't because they're not open. And so it's just like an annoyance rather than anything else at the moment.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on the impending house move. Okay, well, what we've tended to do in this series so far is to sort of start with our brief impressions of this film. Now, I've known it for many years, probably seen it about 5 times, I think, and I would happily watch it again and again. So, Anthony, you knew it already, but I think Frank and Mark didn't know. So let's start with Frank. Have you any sort of impressions, brief impressions about the movie?
I've never seen or even heard of this movie before, and you told me Russell Crowe is in it, so I was like, I'm not a huge fan of his, but I've enjoyed some of his roles, so I was kind of like, oh, okay, we'll see. And I have to admit, the first 20-30 minutes I couldn't quite tell what was going on, because he starts out like in Iran, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of goes from there. I'm like, okay, what's going on? And I didn't kind of understand where the movie was going, and I almost gave up in the first 30 minutes, but then I'm like, oh no, I'll see it and see what happens. And then actually after I got past that first half hour or so, and then they started the whole story with the tobacco stuff, then I started to get a lot more interesting, and then got more and more intense. Then I actually thought the movie was really good. I would definitely watch it again.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because I think that was the weakest part of the film, that introduction.
Oh yeah, I thought it was too.
It's a weird subplot as well. Subplot of the Unabomber was a bit weird as well.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I mean, in real life that probably was brought up during the course of this, but
It's
kind of weird to bring it up in the movie. It didn't fit thematically, so it kind of was like, oh well, yeah. Unabomber.
I think it was, is it in the Wikipedia article or something, it says that it was there to, you know, Wallace and Bergman, just to show their bona fides, as they say, before getting on to the main thing.
Yeah.
Have an idea of who they are and what they did.
I think it's good in that sense, but, if you're watching it as kind of like a edutainment kind of thing, that's good to have that in there. But if you're just watching it as like a Hollywood movie, then it doesn't quite fit. It fits, but it doesn't fit kind of thing.
Yeah, Mark, what did you reckon?
No, I'd have to agree with that, actually, in the sense that coming to it cold, you think, oh, it's a film about, this war zone and terrorism, and then suddenly it just switches to something completely different, and you realise, oh, it's just set dressing. It's just, okay, this is the sort of man he is. He makes broker's deals with powerful, dangerous people, and he does what he says, and he's a mover and a shaker, and people trust him. So it could have been a bit shorter, that whole sequence.
Yeah.
The film, I suppose, is so sedentary. There's a lot of tension, but there's no real action as such. I guess they thought, well, we'll try and get people drawn in with action, with guns and, almost not a car chase, but, driving along, where are they going, all danger. And then once they hook you, then they go into the story proper. I don't think you particularly needed that, to be honest.
No, maybe not.
It's a long film, and there are bits I probably would have snipped a bit shorter. I thought it was a very good film. I mean, I did enjoy it. I had nothing. I didn't know anything about it until you told me about it, Julian. I enjoyed it, and it's one of those, it's interesting what you were sort of saying about newspapers and the media. the film is basically saying, look at the media, put them up on the pedestal. They're the people who, you know, we look up to find the truth. And yet, you know, in this day and age, it's not really the case anymore, is it, really?
And even then, as Frank said, you know, the story almost didn't come out then.
Yeah.
How many, you know, what percentage of stories never come out? It must be vast.
I really enjoyed it with a few reservations. I thought, I thought Russell Crowe, he's basically giving the same performance he gives in A Beautiful Mind.
Yes, I was going to mention that, actually.
Which, yeah. I love A Beautiful Mind, and I just thought, this one
came first, so I suppose he gets more credit for this.
I just didn't quite believe him. I believe Pacino, fantastic performance. Yeah, I just thought Russell Crowe was a bit acting, a little bit actor-y.
Well, we will come back to that, because I'm going to echo that point when we come to talk about his performance in particular. I think you're absolutely right. I'm going to ask Anthony now to do the hardest thing, which, of course, is to come third in the row here to give your brief impressions.
Well, I think I'd seen this at the cinema. So it came out in 99, so it probably would have been in the cinema in England in, 99 or 2000. I think it fits so well with all the stuff that we've talked about on this show before, Julian?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just made for us to review, really.
Yes, it is.
So it was kind of a fresh watch, but I think I knew I remembered the story pretty well. Mm. And I think it has a complicated plot, but I think because the central thing is so simple, really, which is, you know, is journalism about news gathering or pandering to your corporate bosses? Mm. And then, with the whistleblower, what's more important, the truth or protecting your family? So it's got, we'll get to themes later, but I was just really impressed with it. I watched it in two parts, I think. Yeah, it was good. Pacino, loads of energy, but not parodying himself as he's done in recent films with all the shouting, you know. And I did make a shout count, which we'll use later. But
when we talk about him in a few minutes from now, then yes, I shall get you to do that.
No, it's great. The two leads were really strong and... it was long and definitely, you know, I think those subplots could have been removed and it still would have been a pretty long film, but didn't seem to drag, really. I enjoyed it a lot.
That's an important thing for people to realise if they haven't seen it, that although it is convoluted, the way it is directed and the pace of the film means that you can keep up. It's well done. You know, even if at the end of it you couldn't actually piece it all together and tell somebody else, it doesn't really matter. You get the gist of it very clearly. Okay, so what I do is to give a plot summary. Now, this time it is going to be a massively long plot summary, just because the way it is, a complicated story. So I'll do what I can here. If I do miss anything crucial, do let me know at the end, will you? And I'll do my best here to condense it. Okay, so... All right, now the film opens, as we've already said, a little oddly with a car journey. We see this blindfolded man being escorted by these armed guards to a secret location. I think it might be Beirut. And this is Lowell Bergman, the producer of the famous 60 Minutes programme, and he's played by Al Pacino. And he's on his way to talk to Grand Ayatollah Mohammed Fadlallah of Hezbollah in the hope of setting up an interview with Mike Wallace, the famous broadcaster who headed up 60 Minutes for decades. Mike Wallace is played by Christopher Plummer, of all people. So as we said, this seems a little odd because then the action shifts to the US. And we then see this Dr. Jeffrey Wigand, played by Russell Crowe, leaving the tobacco company, Brown and Williamson. You know, he's worked there as head of research and development, and indeed as a vice president of that company. And he's leaving there ominously in slow motion because he's been fired. We don't know why. So he goes home to his massive house in Louisville, Kentucky, to his wife, his two young girls. He tries to hide this fact from them, bottles it all up. But the truth, of course, comes out. He's lost his job, and their $300,000 per year lifestyle is now all over. And then we these narratives, in a sense, get connected because Lowell Bergman, the 60 Minutes producer, he's working on a cigarette safety story for CBS. And he needs somebody to translate into layman's language this large technical document that he's got. So through a contact, he approaches Jeffrey Wigand, of course, who is now looking for work. And Wigand agrees. But then this is a really crucial thing that happens in the film. Wigand really intrigues Bergman by saying, yes, he'll work on this document. But he refuses to say anything else because of a confidentiality agreement. And of course, Bergman's going, what? What do you mean? I would say anything else? What have I stumbled on here? So he pursues the matter, but you know, Wigand won't say anything. We then see Wigand summoned to a meeting of the CEO of Brown & Williamson, played by Michael Gambon, because they want him to sign an enhanced confidentiality agreement so that he can say nothing about the inner workings of the company. And if he doesn't sign it, he's going to lose all his ex-company benefits, his medical insurance, crucially, that's going to go. And of course, Weigand is furious by that, but he later feels he has to sign it. But as a consequence, Weigand feels more like speaking to Bergman. So he tells Bergman that after he's had this highly successful career in the health industry, working for companies like Johnson & Johnson and Union Carbide and Pfizer, he joins Brown & Williamson because he thought he was going to be able to work on developing a safer cigarette. The money was good as well, but he thought he was going to be able to do some good. And things didn't work out that way. He doesn't reveal anything yet, but Bergman knows there is a significant story here. So we then see Weigand and his family move into a more modest house, still a nice house, mind, but quite a modest house. And he starts work as a high school teacher, earning far less than he ever did before, you know. And then Weigand and his family receive these mysterious death threats. The most sinister one is he discovers a bullet carefully placed in the mailbox outside. And to cut a long story short, and I said I'd do this, after this loads of legal intrigue, fascinating, you know, it's on the edge of your chair stuff, involving gag orders and depositions to court and a weird legal threat called tortious interference, eventually Weigand does in fact agree to this 60 Minutes interview with Mike Wallace to reveal all, and it gets recorded, and he states the reason why he was fired. Because he raised objections within the tobacco company, Brown & Williamson, about their deliberate policy of making cigarettes more addictive, contrary to their public statements that they believed nicotine to be not addictive. And he had a particular thing that really bothered him, that they'd been using a substance called coumarin that he said, you know, enhanced the tobacco flavour, and Weigand believed that to be a carcinogen. And that scene closely follows the actual footage of the 60 Minutes interview that was broadcast eventually. But then, as irony has it, because of political machinations at CBS itself, the decision is taken to prevent that interview going on air. And instead, the management decides to put out what they call an alternative version with no names, no faces, no specifics, so as to protect CBS from this possible litigation by lawyers from Brown & Williamson. So Lowell Bergman is livid. Mike Wallace seems to go along with that decision. We may discuss that in a few minutes from now as to whether that was true or not. Mike Wallace himself criticised the film for that. Weigand is devastated. You know, he's risked everything. He's lost nearly everything. And now his story is basically canned. But not all is lost, because Bergman manages to persuade the New York Times to publish the story instead, revealing everything on the front page and criticising CBS in the process. And now the story's come out, Mike Wallace and the others realise their mistake and give the green light for the interview with Weigand to go out on the CBS network. And the movie ends as Bergman announces his resignation, saying, you know, 60 Minutes is permanently tainted. And he exits the CBS building in slow motion, as Weigand had left in slow motion from his offices at the beginning of the movie. And at the end, just for the credits, we learn that in 1998, the tobacco industry settled a US-wide lawsuit against it for $246 billion, you know, with the clear implication that Weigand's testimony played a big part in opening up that possibility. So there you go. I told you it would be quite a long summary. Is there anything, chaps, that you think I missed out crucially? Anything I got wrong?
No, I think it's difficult to go through all those legal machinations. Mm. I think you just have to say there's a lot of them.
Yes.
But it's really about, you know, it's about deceit, and it's about power, and it's about levels of power. But I think the central thing is about journalism versus business, isn't it, really, in terms of CBS? But,
yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about the production then. So we're mentioning about the actors. We've already said a few things about it. So we have Russell Crowe here as Jeffrey Weigand. Mark, you said wasn't totally convincing. I have to say, I like his performance, and I know that Jeffrey Weigand himself was well satisfied with the performance. That he thought it was sort of uncanny, actually. There were certain aspects of the way Crowe portrayed him that he thought, you know, he was almost watching himself. But I kind of agree with you that watching the real Weigand in interview, he's more outgoing and he's less socially awkward than the way Crowe played it.
Yeah, if somebody said to me that Russell Crowe was going to play me in a film, I'd be very happy. It's a very, very classy film. There are very good performances. And for me, two stood out as not being good. And that's because they're surrounded by some superb actors. He just came over as acting. He came over as doing an impression of the real Jeffrey, which is interesting what you said. You said he was an uncannily like him. I think if he'd been perhaps played him as an inner Russell Crowe rather than trying to be someone else, it might have just been a bit more credible. To me, I just found it, and also very, very similar to Beautiful Mind performance. I know this came first, but, you know, Beautiful Mind, this is a person who's got, you know, multiple personality disorder, et cetera, et cetera. And again, it just seemed, here's an actor who has got half an eye on an Oscar and trying to do all these quirky, against Al Pacino, who just fully inhabited his person. You just felt like he was a TV producer, that's it.
Absolutely, yeah.
I just thought it was a little bit of a clash of acting styles.
Yes, I thought...
Not to say it wasn't...
Yeah, sorry, yeah.
No, I mean, that's... And also, the other actor, I didn't think... I mean, Michael Gambon, bless his heart. Why not just get an American to play that character?
Get a real
that
southerner,
Terrible accent. I'm sorry, that's a terrible...
I don't agree. Tobacco.
Absolutely.
Oh,
outrageous. Well, the problem with that was he switched from doing this sort of general southern states accent for one sentence then to talk in English accent for the next sentence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's funny because, you know, this is a film where the truth is being hidebound by money and power, etc. Well, you know, this film got made because somebody said, let's cast this person. Doesn't matter whether they fit the parts. And I would say there's, you know, they get a certain amount of money for Michael Gambon, even though they could cast an American unknown who would be perfect. Okay, this is a very good film. It does expose stuff, but the film itself is a little bit stymied by stunt casting.
Yeah, they were trying to bring the British audience in, presumably.
They have to. I mean, I understand it. For any film to get made, they have to have actors on board who people know. They can't have a film of unknowns. I understand the process, but I just think sometimes it doesn't work.
Sure.
I mean, it was a very classy film, I mean, in terms of performances, which I think makes one or two performances just, for me, don't quite work well enough.
He's had an incredible late career, hasn't he, Christopher Plummer?
I mean, yeah.
I was looking on Wikipedia. I think he's 90, and he did a film last year, actually.
Knives Out. He was in Knives Out, which is I love that film, and he was very good in that. And of course, he was cast as when what's the name was pulled from a film, wasn't he, about Onassis a couple of years ago? They reshot the film with him. He was excellent.
Yes, he was. Yes, he got the delivery of Wallace's voice really well. I thought that sort of emphatic style, and then having a little pause before your next emphatic thing. I thought he got that really well.
Yeah. Can I just say my favourite Pacino moment very quickly?
Go on.
It's a really silly bit right at the beginning where he takes his glasses off and he just puts his hand up to stop them falling off the desk, and it's just so lovely and natural. You can tell he's just thought of that and done it. I thought, okay, fine, I'm in safe hands now. It sounds really strange, but it was such a small moment.
No, I know. I didn't pick up on that one. That's one of the marks of a fantastic performance, isn't it? Each one of us picks up on some particular thing that impresses us.
Yeah.
And I would say that, you know, one thing about his performance in particular that impressed me was when they were in that hotel room, he just asked him about, you know, translating that document. Then the guy says, I'm not going to tell you anything, but I used to be a vice president for this third biggest tobacco company in the US. And at that point, you know, Al Pacino's eyes look at him like a hawk, and they just sort of follow him as he walks across the room. I just thought that was...
Yeah.
He didn't need to do anything else. Excellent.
Yeah.
Can I just go back to Russell Crowe? Because it was interesting that Michael Mann, in interview, said that he got Crowe in for a 2 or 3 hour script reading. And after a couple of hours, he was just saying to himself, well, you know, this is going nowhere. You know, Crowe isn't right for the part. And then he said some line to do with, you know, this story isn't going to see the light of day. And he looked down, and there was something in the dejection that Crowe exuded at that point that he just knew that he was right for the part. So it's interesting, isn't it, that he thought there was something in Russell Crowe that was absolutely right for this. See, I think the opposite of what you said, Mark, that I don't think he was... I know what you mean about he was picking up on particular mannerisms, but I don't think he just tried to do an impression.
Right.
To my mind, it was Russell Crowe's interpretation of Jeffrey Wigand, but I, you know, it's difficult to judge this kind of thing.
I think he's a good actor, and I think he's underrated, so I'm not dissing the guy at all. I think he's a very good actor. I think it's such a strong film that I just felt, as I say, I just felt like he was acting, whereas the others were being more natural, but, you know.
Yeah, and we're talking at a high level, aren't we? Yeah.
These
talents. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
A nice touch was Mike Moore, the Attorney General of Mississippi, was actually played by the actual chap himself, wasn't he? I thought it was a nice...
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, that was...
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he was good because he didn't stand out as being not a professional actor. You know, he was just part of the cast, and I thought it was a really good idea to include him.
Oh, yeah.
I want to bring in Frank here, if you've got anything to say about any of these actors, Frank.
Whenever I see Al Pacino in a movie, I kind of feel he tends to play a lot of the same characters, but it wasn't so jarring here because that character, I think, was supposed to be a little bit abrasive but kind of trustworthy. And I don't know. I think Pacino played him well. On your recommendation, I did watch the real Weigand interview, and I thought Crow did a pretty good job, but I have a hard time getting into Crow's performances sometimes. I don't know why, but I liked him in Gladiator, and I thought he did okay in here too, but I just feel like he's one of those people who is like, it's Russell Crowe playing this person, yeah, like his impression or impersonation of the character. Okay.
Do you think if we hadn't seen any Russell Crowe that we would still think that, or is it because we've all seen Gladiator and stuff that
I think perhaps... I think you're on that. Yeah, I think it's probably because we've seen Gladiator and we've seen him do these other performances. I think if this was the first Russell Crowe movie you'd ever see, you'd probably be okay with it. Yeah.
But you see, I haven't seen him play Gladiator, so maybe that's
Oh, that's a good movie.
It's a great movie.
I like it. Yeah. But I think my favorite performance in the movie, though, was probably Christopher Plummer. I think he's a great actor. I don't see him in enough stuff. Mm-hmm. And I thought he did a really great Mike Wallace performance. I even went back and watched that interview, like I said, and then I'm like, oh, that's pretty good. And I might actually go back and watch some Mike Wallace interviews now. I don't know. I think, Julian, you had asked me, too, in private chat about the Southern accent.
I had, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, it was that guy's accent was terrible.
It was.
I'm glad I'm not the only person who thought that. Yeah, I like Michael Gambon, usually. It was just that.
Yeah.
It was just not his thing, was it?
Perhaps my view of him has been coloured slightly by he was in a Doctor Who episode, and I'm a Doctor Who fan. And the strong rumour was it, amongst all the backstage people, was that he had no idea what he was saying. He literally just did it for the money. So he looks good and sounds good, but he just doesn't. No, that might just be Doctor Who. Yeah. But I think he does a lot of films, and I don't think he necessarily, shall we say, invests much other than just reads the script. But I thought the accent was, yeah, really jarred. Really jarred.
That was the weakest thing in the film for me, for sure.
Yeah.
Going
back, can I just mention, just a quick word about the script I thought was particularly good.
Yes. I was coming on to ask about that, so that's absolutely fine, yeah.
Oh, right.
What do you think about the script?
Well, actually, I should mention that. There was some great, I made a note of a line, ordinary people under extraordinary pressure, I think is when Christopher Columbus says, why is he behaving like that? Mm. And it's full of nice little believable things people would actually say. Mm. And there's a lovely moment that you could have cut, but I think it added to it, was there's some news report about the Canadian Mounties. And Pacino was going, why is he focusing on those horses? Why are we going to show those horses? It's nothing to do with anything, but it just shows you what life is like in a sort of in a newsroom and the banter and the quirkiness. Mm-hmm. So I thought it's a really strong script. And as you said, when you tried to explain the story to somebody, you might have struggled to go into the details. But the broad sweep of the story, apart from, I think, the early 10 minutes, the broad sweep of the story, you could follow it. You didn't need to know the ins and outs of everything. I thought the script was very strong, yeah.
It was, indeed. In fact, it's interesting you say there's some sort of detail in there. It was based upon a Vanity Fair article called The Man Who Knew Too Much about Weigand's experience. And I noticed, having read not all of that article in Vanity Fair, because it's extremely long, but I did notice how a lot of the detail of that was actually included in the film. Right. But it wasn't included in a sort of info dump way. It was carefully woven into the dialogue throughout the film, and I thought that was really cleverly done. In fact, you know, that's one of the main things about this. So I didn't notice any info dumps at all in the dialogue.
No.
Everything naturally flowed out of the conversations and you were informed by that. But there was nothing where you thought, oh, this is a Columbo moment, you know.
But they say, you remember that program we worked on last year?
Yes, that sort of thing.
There was nothing
like that at all.
Yes,
no.
Yes, of course I do. Why you, yes.
That takes a lot of effort and thought, imagining how this is going to unfold before the camera to make that sort of thing work. And they obviously did that brilliantly. That's Michael Mann and Eric Roth wrote it together.
I suppose they're actually giving the audience some credence for understanding it without having it, you know, laid down.
Maybe it's not a surprise that this film wasn't a massive commercial success, but I think it was a critical success.
Yeah.
You know, it's got no sex and violence at all, so it has to rely on...
That's quite true.
That's why I'd forgive it a couple of Hollywood tropes, you know, because it's not full of them, yeah. It's just a few things.
No.
I mean, that's normal though, isn't it? You condense characters and things, but according to that podcast that I was telling you guys about, History by Hollywood, they said it was pretty accurate.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good.
Yeah, Wygand said that he thought it was accurate to the emotions of the situation.
Right.
Because so much of it had to be condensed down. But I mean, Mike Wallace said he thought it was like 2/3 accurate. But he had an axe to grind that maybe we would talk about in a bit.
I think he was unhappy for CBS as well, I think, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Not just for himself. Like.
I think so, yeah. I mean, Michael Mann said that one of the reasons why it wasn't a success was that he is a director. He's not a salesman. So he's not really interested in pitching the film to an audience, you know? He just wants to get on with the business of making the film. I connect with that. But he also thought it's, you know, it's really difficult to communicate to people what this film is about. He said something like, perhaps smokers felt they were going to be preached at, and non-smokers thought, well, I don't smoke, so it's got nothing to do with me. So, you know, difficult one to sell to people, perhaps.
I think the smoking is almost like a backdrop.
It is.
Probably my favourite film of all time is Raging Bull, you know, about Jake LaMotta and boxing. And all I was going to say was that the boxing is the backdrop. You know, the ring represents life, how we're all trapped and we all make our own traps and everything. It could almost be a fiction. I mean, obviously, it's based on a real event, but you could use the tobacco thing as an example, you know, as a backdrop for all kinds of other things. Because I think the themes of it, I don't think they're about tobacco, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It's about power and it's about discrediting, and it's how it would be possible to discredit pretty much everybody, you know, if you went after them. You know?
Indeed. Yeah.
But, well, if somebody says who doesn't have any flaws. I mean, I was wondering about the theme. I mean, you know, the tobacco was sort of incidental, wasn't it? I mean, it was essentially about how far are you, anybody, prepared to go to stand up to what you believe is true, I suppose.
I think the way they described the, whatever they called it, tobacco delivery system, basically this poison going directly into the blood-brain barrier, whatever they call it.
Yeah.
There was a heartlessness about that. That was a good way to use that.
Yeah.
That sort of,
yes.
I mean, Julian and I have talked, I don't know how many times, about the corporation as a, on the one hand, an entity that you can't put in jail, you know, corporate personhood. But then it is human beings at the top of the food chain. Yeah. Don't know if I've got an answer to that. But
the great documentary on that, isn't it? The Corporation, which we were going to talk about, but maybe we will at some point. Well, I understand, Anthony, that you've looked into a little bit of this to do with tobacco and toxicity and things. Have you got anything to share with us?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know what or who to believe nowadays in the information age, but this is from the Cancer Research UK website. I mean, I'm an ex-smoker, and I just thought I'd share some information. This is very much going to be anti-smoking propaganda when I start reading this.
Okay, fair enough.
Anyway, I'll just read what it says on the website. I just wrote it down. Cigarettes contain some chemicals found naturally in the tobacco plant. Some are absorbed by the plant from the soil. Some are added when tobacco leaves are processed. But this is the interesting part. Some are only in the smoke coming off a cigarette. And it says 5,000 chemicals are released when a cigarette burns, many of which are carcinogenic. And for any youngsters thinking of taking up smoking, have a listen to this. Some of the things included benzene, which is an industrial solvent, chromium, used to manufacture dye and paint, polonium-210, which is obviously radioactive, beryllium, used in nuclear reactors, etc., etc., arsenic, which we know about, formaldehyde, which you've surely heard of, and finally, polycyclic aromatic, can't read my own writing, hydrocarbons, a group of dangerous DNA-damaging chemicals. On a slightly comical note, the actual link between smoking and lung cancer was announced in Britain. I'm not sure what about in the States, but in February 1954, the Minister for Health, Mr. Ian MacLeod, announced in the House of Commons that the relationship between smoking and lung cancer must now be regarded as established. And there was a press conference, and I did read in one book that he was actually smoking at the press conference. Those were the days where you could just wear two hats at the same time. You know, you could be the Minister for Health. And you could also be a smoker at exactly the same moment. So probably wouldn't have been allowed to do that nowadays, would he?
Those old public information films, black and white ones, where the doctor's telling a woman about something and he's smoking and sort of talking to her about her health.
Absolutely.
They were marketed at one point a long time ago as being good, weren't they? And they actually had doctors smoking cigarettes to recommend them to consumers, I think.
I remember seeing ads about that. You know, doctors recommend this brand of cigarettes. You can find ads on the internet that show that. Yeah, absolutely.
Of course, heroin was famously a cough mixture in the 1890s. Cocaine was in Coca-Cola. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we had tobacco advertising, didn't we, Julian, in the UK? Until when? I don't know. For sports events and things.
Oh, yes.
Hugely ironic.
Yeah, we used to have cigar adverts on the TV, didn't we? Hamlet and...
Mm-hmm.
Condor, was that pipe tobacco? I'm not sure. But the guy used to come out and say, Condor. Condor. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Hamlet the mild cigar.
Mm. I might add, by the way, for listeners, that there is no advertising revenue here, by the way.
Oh, yes. Sponsored by Embassy.
Yeah, sponsored by nobody whatsoever. No, okay.
Well, I mean, we can laugh at the 80s, you know, sports events having a tobacco advertising, but the 2012 Olympics in London was partly sponsored by Coca-Cola and McDonald's, so we may not have moved on that much.
Yeah, indeed.
We could do a podcast about the film The Founder, which is, of course, all about how McDonald's came into being. That's powerful stuff, very depressing stuff. Oh, gosh. Yeah.
Okay, well, I didn't mention the music, perhaps I just quickly mention the music. All right, so the music was mainly by Lisa Gerrard and Peter Bork. A few other people were involved in this as well. The most effective piece was not by them, but by the Argentinian Gustavo Santaolalla, classical guitar piece called Iguazu. That was excellent.
I've been to Iguazu as well.
Ah, have you? Yeah.
I thought I heard his music in there because I picked up on Gustavo's music way in the movie. Other than that, I didn't pick up anything. Hmm? I'm like, hey, is that Gustavo? And then I looked at who did the music. I'm like, oh, I guess I was wrong. But no, I'm a huge fan of his.
Ah. It was beautifully used, wasn't it, in the film, for those key moments of solemnity, melancholy. It was just excellent.
Yeah, I mean, they could have really gone for the sweeping music, couldn't they? And they restrained themselves.
Mm.
Yeah. You know?
Mm. And Lisa Gerrard, I believe she sang her own stuff there, and her haunting voice, I thought, was quite effectively used. Not the kind of music you'd expect in a thriller, really. It was almost like a weird sort of melancholic commentary upon what was going on, you know, rather than music to accompany the film, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I didn't really notice it that much, which I consider
there you go.
An okay thing. Yeah, yeah, I'm happy with that.
Mm.
It doesn't seem like to be used as a tool. Yeah, like I said, they could have really gone full bore with it, turned up, you know, the emotion.
Mm.
That would have been too much, but they restrained themselves.
Well, they did that sort of in Beautiful Mind, didn't they?
Did they? I haven't seen that film for so long.
I mean, it's a brilliant score. I love the film, but it does get the emotions going. You know, it does. You think, oh, I'm going to sit this one out, but it's very hard to. But this, no, is. Insider was, as you say, if you didn't notice the music, I think it's done its job, isn't it?
Yeah.
There was a really fantastic moment when that guitar music was used, I thought, when Wigan was on his way to the deposition at Mississippi, and he was back in a car again, being chauffeured, and there was a lot of visual stuff going on, lots of cars moving around, motorbikes, but you couldn't hear anything. They turned off the sound. All you could hear was the guitar. It was as if that was kind of inside his head now. So you were hearing the music of his melancholic mind detached from everything around him.
Yeah.
I just thought that was... And that actually fitted with what Michael Mann said was the key moment of the movie, and apparently Wigand agreed, which was shortly after where he was standing in front of the court deciding, shall I go in and give this deposition? You know, I could go to jail for this or not. You know, do I actually step in there? And he says, let's go to court. He actually makes that decision. So, you know, I thought the way that the music added to that directorially was just superb at that point.
Mm.
Some select scenes then. Okay, have you got any particular scenes that you chaps want to talk about? I've got a couple here, but what do you reckon?
I'd actually say rather than a scene, it was more of a line. I didn't write the line down, so I'm paraphrasing. It's what we kind of said earlier. Who wouldn't have dirt on them if you probe deeply enough?
Mm.
You know, I can't remember which scene that was exactly, but reminded me, Julian, of I know you and I are big fans of Yes Minister. I can imagine Marcus as well, probably. We talked about, you know, the MI5 files, you know. If you want to stop someone becoming Prime Minister, get their MI5 file opened, you know.
And the funny thing is, I think we said again that Annie Machon, I heard her interviewed saying that, yeah, all these members of Parliament, etc., especially the high up ones, yeah, they've all got a file. It's all there. It's true.
Yeah. But I think it's quite a profound idea. It's about, you know, it wouldn't be that difficult to find dirt on anyone.
Mm.
And of course, it's the way, you know, we've talked about media before. It's the way it's presented.
Mm.
I still think most people, even if they'll say, oh, I don't believe it's in the media, you know, it's a very, very slick, well-oiled machine, you know.
It's the old courtroom argument, isn't it? If somebody lies or covers up one aspect, then that means automatically they're lying about everything.
Yeah.
You know, which is ridiculous, but it has a sort of logic, even though it's completely illogical.
Mm.
Because I think people want to believe that whistleblowers or whoever are, you know, goody two-shoes, they've done nothing wrong. And the moment you realise, oh, they've had a life like everybody else, then you're less likely to believe them, which is crazy, which is illogical, because we've all done things we're not proud of, I'm sure.
Yeah. And this is all because, isn't it, that the film says that Brown and Williamson employed people to go out looking for dirt on Wygand and producing this dossier. And
500 pages.
500
pages.
Yeah.
Incredible.
So, rather than a scene, for me, that was kind of the key line. And there was just one other one where they talked about, again, I have to paraphrase, but sort of the idea of are we newspeople or businessmen, talking about CBS. So it's the idea of Pacino wants to see himself at his essence as a sort of an artist, you know, a journalist as a kind of artist doing the craft of information gathering. Are you that, or, I mean, obviously you're part of a business. Mm-hmm. That's the whole thing that you can't avoid, you know.
Yeah.
You can't work for CBS and then claim that there's no business slant to the news because, you know.
No, I did feel rather that at some point Jeffrey was right when he said, I'm being used, you're using me as a way of getting an hour of exciting television. They want to get an audience. An audience equates to money, doesn't it? It's all about money, ultimately.
I think the script, they got it right with Bergman, Pacino, because he did come across as quite honourable and having some integrity, but then they didn't do the sort of Hollywood trick of making it too simple and making him out to be some sort of martyr.
No, no.
I'm pleased they did that. Probably would have made more money if they'd done that, though.
Yeah.
So it's to the credit. Sometimes it's to the credit that something doesn't make a lot of money, weirdly enough.
Absolutely. Yeah. Totally, yeah.
Frank, did you have any particular scenes that stood out?
Yeah, no, I just kind of wanted to piggyback on your guys' comment about the news being the business, you know, because I had a journalism class in high school, and the teacher told us, she's like, you know, when I found out what the whole point of newspapers was, I almost choked. And then she's like, you know, the whole point of newspapers is to sell ads.
That was Chomsky that opened my eyes up to that. I read this book, Chomsky for Beginners, and it was so full of good stuff. In my innocence, I'd never even considered that until I read it in that book.
Well, can I come to one of the scenes that I mentioned it earlier, and I think, Mark, you said you wanted to say something about this. It's the golfing range scene.
Yes.
Okay, so this is after Jeffrey Wygand's been called to see the CEO of Brown & Williamson, so they can sort of bully him into signing this enhanced confidentiality agreement. So then after that, we get this scene set at night at a golf driving range. This is completely fictional, never happened, but we see Wygand practicing his golf swings, semi-lit. And then in the distance, just close enough so you can just about make out facial expressions, you see another lone figure, also ostensibly practicing golf, immaculately dressed in a suit, and he makes it clear that he's there to spook out Wygand. Now, I love the fact, actually, that this didn't happen, and yet, you know, Wygand himself said this captured the atmosphere, this captured the emotion of what he was experiencing, so I thought that worked well, but... Mark, go on.
No, I did. I made a note of it, but I thought it was a very good scene, a very filmic. There's no dialogue, and it's just, and then in a way, well, nothing happens other than just these two people sort of look at each other. No, I like, in fact, where I lived in Greenwich before, near the O2, the Millennium Dome, as was, there is one of these enormous outdoor golf drives. And it's a very impressive place, and sort of immediately behind it, you've got the whole of Canary Wharf, which looks a bit like Manhattan. It's very filmic. I can understand why they went there. No, I like the scene. It's just got one of my pet hates. It's a thing that it happens in almost every film.
Go on, then.
Whenever they turn the lights on or off, it goes...
Oh, yeah.
And it never happens. Lights don't make a noise. And it annoys me why this happens. And it's, so, well, the lights went off.
This is like noises in space, isn't it?
Yeah, and it just annoys me because it's never happened. So why do people think this should happen? You know, lights don't make a noise when they go on off. They might go, dip, dip, dip. That's it. So now I just made a note because in an otherwise very good film with very few of these cliches or tropes, this just struck me as something they could have done without. But a good scene.
But we can definitely say, Mark, that was a small point, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's just a bugbear. It's a bugbear, and I'm willing to, you know.
Sure.
But, I mean, when you're aware of it, it's like whenever you see a cat in a film or on television, it will always meow. Always. 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 That's another thing that, you know, that annoys me. But anyway.
You're such a perfectionist, Mark.
It's always a very shrill meow as well.
Yeah, and you just think, I know it's a cat. I can see it's a cat. You don't need to have it meowing.
Oh, dear.
Did Wygand have any connection with golf, or do they just totally
I don't know.
Just choose that? was wondering why they chose the driving range, but it was pretty effective.
Mm. Yeah. See, I thought that was effective before I then saw the interview. There's a Charlie Rose interview he did. So I've got the quote here. It's just, this is what Wygand said about that scene. He said, quote, "The scene at the golf driving range in actuality did not happen, okay? But that scene and that emotion and that feeling of being followed and that stomach-wrenching feeling, was it captured by other things that elapsed? Yeah. Was I followed by an ex-FBI agent hired by Brown and Williamson? Yes, fact. Was my domestic attorney's office in Louisville, Kentucky, broken into the day after I retained him? Fact." And he goes on a few more things. He says, "Does that scene capture that emotion? I think it does." So I was really pleased to hear him say that, because at the time I didn't know it didn't happen when I watched it first. And I thought, oh yeah, that really captures things. And so then to find out it was an artistic thing didn't make any difference to me. I thought it was good.
Yeah. And you could almost say it is playing out in his head. I mean, it's that guy is either malevolent or he's not, or he's innocent, but it's the paranoia that's the important thing, isn't it? It's what they're doing to him that's important.
Yeah, that's true.
And also, a thought that's just occurred to me is what I liked about the directorial style. Lots of things I liked. Lots of shots of characters in front of windows, and you saw views. The views seemed to be very important, the views of sea or of Manhattan or of whatever. And that seemed, I don't know what it added, but it added something to the film.
Along those lines? Along those lines, there were a lot of shots at the back of people's heads. Particularly Wygand. You would see him walking, and you'd see the back of his head. And I don't know whether that was inviting the audience to see things, kind of see the same view as him, but not be him, sort of be with him. Mm. I don't know what it is, but I felt it worked. It made me connect to Wygand.
Mm. I think good directors do that, don't they? Put things in, you're not quite sure what it means or what you've seen exactly, but it gives you a sense. I think when you see people looking out on big views, it maybe gives the impression that they're very small, that we're all very small, you know, and that the machine or whatever. I'm just thinking off the top of my head, to be honest.
Especially city views, yes, we're all sort of ants in an ant heap sort of thing.
And the bit before he goes, you mentioned it before about him deciding whether to go to court or not, that's outside, and he's looking out at the sea, and you just have this vast vista of the sea.
That's true.
And you get that quite a lot actually in this film, when Al Pacino is on his little sort of, you know, goes off on vacation, he ends up standing in the sea trying to get the signal on his phone. I thought that's very interesting, because you cut to this shot and there he is in the middle of the water, completely alone, literally at sea almost.
At sea, very good,
And that is traditionally, that's the power of chaos, the primordial powers of the universe sort of thing, and you've got the single lone individual standing in there.
I don't know about you guys, but I'm a terrible geek for director's commentaries, because I love all that stuff. I just lap it up, I tell you. And I think I do like those commentaries, because then stuff like that's brought out. I mean, I haven't heard a commentary of this.
Well, Michael Mann said that this, at the time anyway, this is the favourite thing. He enjoyed doing this more than anything else. So he was obviously heavily invested in this.
It did resemble Heat a little bit, I must say. But Heat obviously has a lot more action. Maybe it's just a kind of a 90s, it's so general, but, you know, a 90s film.
I just say we've lost Frank.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sorry. See you guys.
You're still there. Okay.
Nice to meet you, Frank.
Thanks.
See you again.
Yeah, nice to meet you. I'd love to chat again. But I'll see you guys later.
Yeah. See you then, Frank. Sure. See you.
Bye.
There's one scene that I wanted to highlight, was brilliantly handled, was that discussion in CBS where I think it's four people, including Lowell Bergman and Mike Wallace, over what to do about the Wygand interview. The management recommends, because CBS could be sued, you know, that Wygand interview should be put out in this alternate version, you know, with no names, all that sort of thing. I love the way this was handled, because I just thought particularly Pacino was given the centre of that performance. But you know, the whole way that issue comes up, and you know, the suspicions and their arguments and the betrayal is brought out, and all happens in a few minutes, but it all unfolds naturally and ends with Bergman is angry and Wallace is shouting over him, Lowell, I'm with Don on this. And then suddenly there's silence. It's a fantastic scene.
Yeah, sort of memories of all the President's Men, actually.
Oh, yes.
That was inside the Washington Post. Yeah. Sort of echoes of it.
Mm. There are echoes of it, although in some ways this is the opposite of that film, isn't it? Because in that film, the press comes out as the hero, whereas here, although things are sort of okay-ish by the end, you see a lot of the mud, don't you? You see a lot of the machinations making this story almost not come out.
Mm. It was more like the scenes of four or five of them discussing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and you've got the journalist who's obviously focused on the story, and then you've got his boss, the editor, who's got to think of the bigger picture, you know? art over business, isn't it, really?
It's similar to that in the sense there's lots of phone calls going on, and and actually quite exciting phone calls, because there was lots of phone call, get me this number, get call this call, and it all kind of felt exciting. You know, it felt each phone call was going to lead to something else, and a lot of talk. I mean, it's obviously a very talky film, isn't it?
It is. What about the faxes? Wasn't that excellent?
Oh, yes.
So there was a real secrecy here, nothing being said, but being said by fax. Yeah. That was excellent. Just with questions and things. Yeah, it was superb.
It was good. Yeah. And I was going to also mention the inclusion of swearing in it, which never seemed to bother me at all. It all seemed to come out completely naturally from the dialogue. I don't know how you felt.
That's true. Absolutely right. I mean, nothing gratuitous about that.
No, nothing. Sometimes you sort of, after a while, you get sort of a bit, I don't know, embarrassed or uncomfortable. Why do they have this? But this is how real people would have spoken.
Absolutely. It certainly wouldn't have worked, would it, if Lowell Bergman had said, I'm really cross with you, you know.
Gosh darn.
Yes. I'm really irate.
To be there. But it wasn't overdone, was it? It wasn't like peppered throughout. It was just natural, as you say.
Very good.
Perfect. Yeah, I wanted to say about this that, you know, Mike Wallace claimed that he was unfairly represented in this. And there's that quote where he says, 2/3 of the film's quite accurate. It was dramatised excessively. Because he disputed, you know, that he'd sided to that extent with CBS, and, you know, kind of lost his moral compass and then changed his mind later on. He maintained that he always wanted the story to go out in full, and he actually claimed that the film was a lie in that sense. So I thought it's important just to make that point, that he thought he wasn't fairly represented. But I have to say that I did see in the Charlie Rose interview with Wygand, there was a clip included in that interview of Wallace in conversation with people. And I've written this quote down because I thought it sort of rebalanced things a little. Let's quote. This is Wallace speaking. He said, when Don Hewitt and I, it's a bit disjointed because it was off the cuff. You know, he says, when Don Hewitt and I, the executive producer of the broadcast, and I, we were trying to hold it together, and we wanted to put, if we couldn't go with the first piece, we wanted to put a second piece without this fellow on, conceivably. But then it became so obvious, to me anyway, that we were simply dead wrong. And quickly I backed off that, if you will, and said, this is foolishness. This is really foolishness. Now, that quote actually gives the impression to me that he did actually go along with it a little bit, kind of against his better judgment. I kind of go along with him that perhaps the film too much emphasised that, made too much of it, and perhaps it wasn't a strung out thing, you know?
Yeah, but it's a drama. It's a drama. So it was dramatising. Yeah. It was making it a bit more dramatic.
But you see why he was upset by that.
In a way. But then I think if the film had portrayed him as he wanted to be portrayed, he would have come over as a much less interesting character. I think that was a nice thing to have him change his mind like that, and it worked. And it's a film, it's not reality.
You don't think that destroyed his reputation or anything like that?
I have no idea. I have no idea about the facts. No. I never even heard of him before I watched it.
No, I hadn't either. Heard of Edward R. Murrow, but not Mike Wallace.
So I have no idea whether it had any material effect on a TV presenter who's coming to the end of his career anyway. So I don't know. Anything about him, really.
No, sure. Fair enough.
Halfway through, they weren't going to be showing the Wygon interview, but then they had a clip of Mike Wallace. He was basically telling the viewers that a story had been pulled, but he wasn't allowed to name any names. Was that broadcast in the story? Was that?
I think so. I thought it was,
So he did a compromise, and they broadcast the thing where Mike Wallace was saying, we had a guy on, we can't name his name, but the story was suppressed.
I believe that's the case, yes.
I found that a bit weird, to be honest, but I suppose it's about compromise, isn't it, really?
Yeah. You know? Bergman suggested a reason why that was going on, because CBS was being sold to, I think it was Westinghouse.
That's right, yeah.
And he suggested that maybe if CBS was going to lose its value because of a court case or something, you know, that a lot of people would lose out on millions of dollars because of this particular sale.
Yeah.
But there was another thing, didn't come out in the film, but I thought was interesting to mention. This is something that Lowell Bergman mentioned in an interview, was there could have been another factor that Larry Tisch, who was the CEO of CBS, has a son called Andrew Tisch, who was CEO of Lorillard Tobacco Company and was actually one of the so-called seven dwarfs who testified the Congressional Committee, saying they didn't believe nicotine was addictive. So, there was a family interest there, so that could have played a factor in this, you know.
There was a lot at stake, yeah.
Whenever they kept talking about the Brown and Williamson, it sounded as if they were saying BMW.
Yes, yeah, indeed. Yes, that's what I agree, yes. Nothing to do with BMW at all, no.
No, no, I was thinking, is that BMW? Oh, no, BMW, okay, fine. A couple of things I've just written down before I go, that awful bit with the CGI where he's in the hotel room and the wall behind him sort of becomes an image of his children. Didn't like that. I thought that was very obvious.
A little on the nose, as
I said. A little on the nose and not very well done.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's a weird bit where the two children were standing right by this sort of shredder, this kind of implement, and I thought, oh, are they going to have some awful accident? It was so bizarre. The whole moment was odd.
It was out of keeping with the rest of the film, wasn't it, I think?
Totally. Well, CGI in a film like this, when the wall sort of ripples and changes, that could have gone.
It wasn't necessary, because it was clear that he was unwell at that moment and just sitting.
Yeah.
All you needed was him looking at the window, obviously contemplating suicide. That's all you needed.
Yeah.
A little bit catatonic.
Yes. Okay. So we're going to talk about some of the themes and messages, stuff that we haven't already mentioned. So we're going to start with Mark, because Mark's got to go in a minute. Anything we can pick up after you've said your bit? What do you think, Mark?
Well, I think it's sort of been mentioned before. It's not really a film about cigarettes, is it? It's a film about a person choosing how important his family is to him, and how important telling people the truth, unpleasant truth about something is. And it's sort of striking the balance, and it's, you know, putting it to the man, or whatever the expression is. It's, you know, standing up against these vast, faceless corporations.
It's the expression that Michael Mann himself used in the interview. It's about standing up, not backing down, regardless of the cost.
Yeah, it's a film about standing up for what you believe, I would say.
Do you think it inspires us to stand up and speak truth to power, for example? Does it inspire us to do that, or is it just too frightening?
Well, I didn't know where the film's going to go. I mean, I knew it was based on a true story, but I did wonder whether, you know, either he commits suicide or some harm comes to his family. I didn't know. I think it perhaps asks you to think seriously about it. You know, inspire is probably too insipid a word. It sort of says, well, look, if you know something, you know, just have a good think about whether this is worth you doing it and using the right channels. And it's about also the theme of media. I mean, it's changed an awful lot now since the film was made. I mean, you could bypass newspapers and TV, couldn't you, and just stick it on Tweeted or YouTube or whatever and get a following that way.
And then it would call fake news, yeah.
Well, exactly. So I suppose the twin theme of standing up for yourself and also the power, the positive power, although, you know, it was compromised a bit, of media that's actually, you know, socially, whatever the word is used before, it's, which again, I don't think happens so much these days.
Yeah, socially responsible sort of thing.
Yeah, so it was very much a sort of positive spin on that, in the same way as films like Spotlight, and there was a Spielberg film a few years ago that I thought was pretty terrible. Again, it was about newspapers standing up for what they believe.
Well, this is interesting, because I've heard people say that this film does kind of say that the system works, you know, the system of the newspapers revealing truth, etc. And in that sense, it kind of tells us everything's okay, really. The truth will come out. But actually, I'm not sure I agree with that, because looking through this film, although I know what's going to happen in the end, if I came to it fresh again, I think I would re-feel that sense of the truth isn't going to come out. Because, you know, it is, because it's been made into a movie. It wouldn't otherwise be made into a movie. But there's a definite sense of just how incredibly hard it was to get the story out, and how dysfunctional the media actually was. It was incredible it ever did come out. So to me, it says, no, the system doesn't work. This was remarkable that this even happened. And I think Bergman says, you know, he knows of, again, at the time, he knew of only one other case where something as portentous as this came out, with some other case. And considering how many things must go on, I think it shows how dysfunctional the media is even then. And I would think, you know, echoing what Bergman himself has said, is that it's even more dysfunctional now. The system doesn't work.
So the message to take is keep your head down, as it were.
And then, well, perhaps do it for yourself. You know, you mentioned social media, the internet and the alternative. And,
yes.
And if you can't get the message out in the traditional ways, then it's got to be new ways of doing it.
Do a David Icke.
Well, you didn't necessarily do a David Icke, but perhaps do a James Corbett.
Okay, well, in that case, I'm going to go, guys.
All right,
nice to meet you. No, nice to meet you. Enjoy the rest of the podcast.
Thank you very much for coming on, Mark.
Okay. All right. Cheers. Bye.
Oh, we're back again, Julian.
Yes.
The old team.
You won't have to do the Al Pacino now, after all.
No, I lost my nerve. I can do a decent impression, but I don't know. In the moment, I could do a bad impression.
No, don't bother. It's all right. Okay, well, we were on a sort of run there with this thing then. One other thing that I thought was important to mention about this. I think the film does put the lie to the very widespread notion that, it's a little phrase people say, someone would have talked. And there are all sorts of issues like that. And this film shows, I think, very powerful why it is the case that very often people do not talk. We know this is essentially a true story. So therefore, how often does this happen? People are stopped from talking. So I think that's a nonsense phrase. Oh, somebody would have talked. Oh, yeah, right, you know. Considering the powers that are there, I'm surprised anybody ever talks.
Yeah.
Does it say, do you think, that even one person can make a difference?
Hollywood has a funny habit of putting out slightly mixed messages. Because our friend Tom Secker, he's obviously done loads of work about Hollywood and the Pentagon and things like that. Yeah. And I don't have arguments with people anymore, Julian, you'll be pleased to hear, but I used to get into arguments, discussions slash arguments about this, even with my English students, actually. Right. And I'd say, oh, you know, Hollywood, the Pentagon gets the script changed and everything. And they will say, well, how come this film got made? And it's a funny sort of mixed message, because this is a Hollywood film. But then is it encouraging whistleblowers or not? You know, yeah. I think if they'd had the sweeping music at the end, then possibly they might have been encouraging it. I also wouldn't use the word inspire, I don't think.
Okay.
I think it's more... I'm not saying you shouldn't use that word. I'm just saying...
No, I see what you mean.
I think if I was a potential whistleblower and I watched this film...
Encourage, perhaps.
Encourage, yeah. I think encourage to at least weigh it up. Because I think what Mark was saying, the phrase that came in my mind was about, you know, it's a balancing act.
Yeah.
And there's various ones. I mean, Wigand's got a balancing act between truth and protecting his family and keeping his family in the style to which they've been accustomed. And, you know, Al Pacino's character's got a dilemma. And there's a funny parallel also with the people making this film, because they've got to make choices about... How much do we stick to the story? Should we put a trope in here or a trope in there? And to their credit, they didn't. And as I said earlier, that's probably why it didn't make a lot of money, if we're being perfectly honest, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a well-worn formula in Hollywood in all kinds of genres. I think romantic comedies have really nailed it. You know, there's certain things in a romantic comedy that makes you think, I've seen this film 100 times before, even though I've never seen it. So to their credit, they didn't use too much of that.
No. But the reason why I said that was, obviously, his example is really extreme. You know, he was put on the line and asked to possibly sacrifice. Well, he did sacrifice a great deal, but possibly sacrifice everything, you know. So obviously, you know, that's not going to inspire us to act in the same way. You know, that's really frightening.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder if it does encourage us to think that, although we wouldn't have to do, most of us wouldn't have to do a Jeffrey Wigand, there are little things that we may be called to do.
Very much so.
And we can do those faithfully, even though they can be painful, you know, in a much lesser way, but they can be painful. But we must nevertheless do them, because in this film we have one man, you know, he almost gives up, but he doesn't. And because of what he did, changes happened.
Yeah.
It is possible. It is possible in our small ways to make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I do find that not inspiring, but... Yeah, encouraging. You can make a difference. And if we all just made a little difference, it would be a big difference.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the very first talk you and I actually ever did was about changing the discourse, wasn't it? It was about changing the conversation from talking about nothing to talking about something meaningful. And it's a really good film. I enjoyed it a lot.
Okay, well, thanks, Anthony, for coming on to talk about this. And Mark and Frank, who've... both gone for various reasons. We've been talking quite a long time. People may not think we have been, because, of course, this will be cut down to a shorter podcast. We've been talking for almost 2.5 hours now. So, yeah, thanks very much for coming on. It's a long film, so a long discussion. I think we've covered a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And obviously, I am recommending this, and I think everybody on the podcast is recommending this film. I think it's absolutely brilliant. I think most people have probably seen it, but if you haven't seen this, then it's well worth watching. And you know, don't get put off by those first few minutes where you think, well, you know, what's going on? And then suddenly it changes to another scene. And, you know, once you get into it, it all makes sense. And also, please do not be put off by the complexity of this. As we've been discussing it, no doubt it can come over as being extremely convoluted. You might think, I don't want to watch a film like that. But as we've said a number of times in the podcast, as you watch it, it grabs your hand and it leads you through each stage really well, really dramatically. So you never have that sense you don't know what's going on, even if you couldn't actually recount everything at the end. It's brilliantly well acted, I think, and brilliantly directed, and well worth watching. And of course, it connects with so many of the themes here at TMR, which is why we've talked about it. So thanks ever so much for coming on, Anthony, and look forward to you joining us again at some point in the future, either to do another review or perhaps one of our Our head-to-heads.
Yeah. Are we going to finally do the war discussion?
I hope so, yes.
We've been promising your listeners for a long time now.
I've had it on the schedule page for months.
Talking of huge topics.
Yeah, we will do.
Yeah, we're going to do Hearts and Minds. I think I'll watch it anyway again because I do like it. Mm. And yeah, it's been fun. I'd say if anyone, I suppose people probably would have watched it before listening to us, but just in case they haven't, I'd say you don't really need to understand every strand. It's essentially, it's a whistleblower. It's a moral dilemma. The CBS guys are kind of experiencing the same thing. It's a pretty classic story, actually, if you think about it. I wouldn't say it's Shakespearean, but it's not a million miles away from that. These are sort of incredibly classic universal human themes of truth versus, I don't know, practicality.
And watch the interviews with the real Jeffrey Wigand. I shall put some links in the show notes because that's quite interesting to see those connections. And I think Russell Crowe did a good job, but there we are.
Yeah, I think he might be a bit shocked when you see the real Wigand because I felt like he had a lot more energy than Russell Crowe played him.
Yes, he did.
But Russell Crowe, it's good performance. Yeah, very different from Gladiator. If you watch those back-to-back, you'd have a shock. Yeah.
Maybe I will do.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll give you the last opportunity here, Anthony. You were going to do an impersonation of Al Pacino. Can you do that?
All right, practice. All right. Give me a line. It's going to sound awful. Oh,
can I give you a line?
There's a famous line from Godfather Part 3.
Go on, then.
Wait a second. Every time I try to get out, they pull me back in. Didn't sound anything.
Hey, that was pretty good. Perhaps not quite as good as your Roger Moore, but it was pretty good.
Roger Moore's a little bit easier. You just do a generically deep English voice.
It's better than I could do. I had to do a Roger Moore impression for GK, Light Flint Radio. Oh, you don't want to listen to that. Oh, well.
Have you ever seen The Trip with Rob Brydon and Steve Coogan that we were talking about earlier?
No, I haven't.
Great series. It's just sort of a good example of not needing a plot.
Is that Rob Brydon doing the Roger Moore?
Yeah, they both do, but they conclude that Brydon's more entertaining and Coogan's more accurate. So minor impressions of impressions, almost. They're caricatures.
Well, I thought it was both accurate and entertaining, so there you go.
Thank you very much.
Good to speak to you. Thanks very much for coming on, and look forward to speaking to you again soon. And best of luck with the move to your new flat.
Yeah, thanks very much. And always good to be on TMR, and I'll be on again soon.
Cool.
All right, all the best.
Okay.